Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm going to present the fourth in a series of messages that I've done on the book of Daniel. And if I could have some handouts distributed. Last time I was here and gave the message like this, I had handouts. This is a little simpler handout, but it's helpful in keeping some of the names straight. Three previous messages that I've given, we've gone through the first four chapters of the book of Daniel. First two messages is parts one and two. We notice the example that Daniel set and some specific lessons that he left for us today concerning how to cope with and live in a foreign, ungodly culture like Babylon. My last message, part three, focused on the life and times of King Nebuchadnezzar and how God eventually got his full attention and completely humbled him. One of the lessons being that the sooner we respond to God and humble ourselves, the better off we are. Chapter 5 now, as you may already know, is the writing on the wall chapter. It begins about 22 years after the death of King Nebuchadnezzar, which means the events of chapter 5 probably took place at least 22 years after the end of chapter 4, and perhaps as many as 32 years afterwards. But what happened in the meantime? What happened in the interim? We'll take a little time to get historical context and notice some of the chronology. At the end of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is still ruling Babylon, but he's a very changed man. We don't know how many years it was between the time he finished his 7 years of living like a wild animal and then his death, but it appears to have been 10 years or less. By most accounts, though, in the year 561 B.C., you could refer to the handout there. It's one of these fill-in-the-blanks to kind of keep you focused so you don't drop off and nod off while we go through some of the history here. Learn that from the history teachers I've taught with. I think it works a little bit. 561 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar dies. And fill that in. And he is succeeded by his son. His son comes in after him, Evil-Merodach, if that's how his name is pronounced. I think in secular history it's Amel-Marduk or something like that. He's mentioned in the Bible in 2 Kings 25, verse 27, and Jeremiah 52, verse 31. I'm going to read through some of the account in 2 Kings, again, 25. By the way, the first part of his name, Evil, well, that's not necessarily meant to describe his character. He might have been, but I think the evil Marduk can be translated man of Marduk or man who serves the god Marduk, something like that. But evil is not necessarily a descriptor of him. 2 Kings 25, verse 27. Now it came to pass in the 37th year of the captivity of Jehoiachin, there'll be a place to fill that in, 37th year of the captivity of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he began to reign, again, 561 B.C., released Jehoiachin, king of Judah, from prison. Now, Jehoiachin had been taken into captivity when he was 18 years old. He'd actually only ruled for 3 months. So if he was released 37 years later, they'd put him at 55 years old. 28, verse 28. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a more prominent seat than those of the kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin changed from his prison garments, and he ate bread regularly before the king all the days of his life. And as for his provisions, there was a regular ration given him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. And I'm not sure who it's referring to and when it says his life. But anyway, Evil-Merodach treated him kindly. But this might not have lasted for very long, though, because the next year, 560 B.C., Evil-Merodach is, fill in the blank there, assassinated. He's assassinated by Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law, Nergal-Sharezer. Nergal-Sharezer, if that's how his name is said, is not mentioned in the Bible, but he ruled for about 4 years until 556 B.C., when he died and was replaced by his son, Labashi-Marduk, also not mentioned in the Bible. Only know about him from secular history. Apparently, Labashi-Marduk was still a child. Not sure how old, but he said he was a child. He ruled only 9 months and then was assassinated or murdered. Things were going downhill in Babylon at that time. He was replaced by another of Nebuchadnezzar's sons-in-law, somebody married to one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, named Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is another one who is not mentioned in the Bible, and we only know of through secular history. After about 5 years, 550 B.C., Nabonidus appointed his son, Belshazzar, as a co-regent or a co-ruler with him. Some historians think that Nabonidus went into sort of a semi-exile, self-imposed exile, or a semi-retirement, and spent time away from Babylon. Now, since the wife of Nabonidus was one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, this makes Belshazzar a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Still in 550 B.C., in the first year of Belshazzar's reign, Daniel has a prophetic dream and a vision of four great prophetic beasts. He writes it down, but doesn't appear to tell anybody about it. And the vision is recorded in chapter 7 of Daniel. So we notice the chapters are not in sequence. Things are out of order here. Daniel at this time is about 70 years old. 2 years later, 548 B.C., it's the third year of Belshazzar's reign. That's how we get to some of the time for reference here. And Daniel has another prophetic vision, this time of the ram and the male goat, which the angel Gabriel then explains to him represents the future conquest of the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire. And all of this is recorded in the eighth chapter, chapter 8 of Daniel. So again, things not quite in order. And now, 9 years after chapter 8, we come forward to 539 B.C., and now it's time for chapter 5. And again, the sequencing is not according to the chapters. Now, according to some accounts, including our old church literature, the date for the events of chapter 5 is October 13th, 539 B.C., and Daniel now is about 80 years old, give or take a few years. So this sets us up for Belshazzar's feast and the writing on the wall, chapter 5. So we're going to go to Daniel, fifth chapter of Daniel, and we'll start reading through here. Daniel 5, verse 1, Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. It's a lot of people. Drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted of the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Okay, so you might ask, why does it say Belshazzar's father, not grandfather, was Nebuchadnezzar? Well, it turns out that neither in the Hebrew nor the Chaldee language is there any one word, apparently, for grandfather. In fact, in the old King James Version, I couldn't find any instances of the use of the word grandfather. So sometimes, as in this case, the word father could have been better translated ancestor. Verse 3. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So we've got a supernatural event here with a disembodied hand. Verse 6, the king's countenance changed and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. So he was quite frightened. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, garments of royalty, and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. He'd be rewarded with status, riches, and power. He'd be the third ruler, along with Belshazzar and Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus. Verse 8. Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. Verse 10, the queen, now probably the queen mother, that is the wife of Nabonidus and mother of Belshazzar, although there's some who say it could have been even the wife of Nebuchadnezzar. But the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, or ancestor, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your ancestor, your grandfather, the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who's the one of the captives from Judah, whom my ancestor, the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, You shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself. Give your rewards to another. Notice here that Daniel doesn't want to enrich himself because of something that God is going to be doing through him. Good lesson. True servants of God are not motivated to enrich themselves because of their service. Not that there's anything wrong with paying a minister, Mr. Light, in the future. No. We do need a paid ministry. Ministers are workmen worthy of their wages. 1 Timothy 5. We do occasionally notice, though, that there's some high-profile, charismatic evangelical types who have, in fact, abused their positions and lived kind of a lavish lifestyle off the tithes and offerings of their church members. Going back to verse 17, though, yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your ancestor, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. God allowed Nebuchadnezzar to exercise tremendous power and authority. Verse 20. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he, Nebuchadnezzar, was deposed from his kingly throne, and he took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, well, his grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although, notice this, you knew all this. You should have learned from your grandfather's mistake. Sometimes the lessons of one generation just don't seem to register with the next. And of course, we'll see here, and it's much better to learn from the prior mistakes of other people rather than to have to learn them from your own mistakes. Verse 23, and you've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you've praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. You're engaged in idol worshiping. You're worshiping materialism. You've made gods of your possessions. Continue in verse 25. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. You don't even encourage or acknowledge the true God. Verse 24. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and his writing was written. And this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Two words, mene and tekel, refer to measures of money. Perez, and I've forgotten, Perez, is that the singular or the plural of upharsin? One or the other. Maybe somebody out there knows. Not that it matters for this point here. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So Belshazzar kept his promise. I guess he couldn't go back on it with thousands of witnesses there. The position, however, was only going to last for a few more hours. Verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being 62 years old. The background story of the Mede and Persian conquest of Babylon, as some of you may know, involved an ambitious project of diverting the flow of the Euphrates River upstream from where it flowed through the walls of Babylon. The giant walls there must have had an opening and protected by a gate. But anyway, they somehow diverted the flow of the water upstream. And without water in the riverbed, the armies could march under the gates into the city and somehow got through gates or over the walls that lined the river inside the city. And once inside, the Medes and the Persians quickly gained control, surprising everybody there. And they put King Belshazzar to death and put an end to the great Babylonian Empire. So what are some of the things that led to this? Or more specifically, what did Belshazzar do wrong? What were his mistakes? What were his shortcomings? What things can we identify and learn from in chapter 5? Well, I've got a list of seven on the back of the note sheet there. I put space where you could write in the seven. Anyway, these are the seven that I came up with, that I enumerated. Number one, Belshazzar put pleasure ahead of his responsibilities. Put pleasure ahead of his responsibilities. Verse 1, he was throwing a big drinking party, and he was doing it foolishly and selfishly at a time when he should have been performing his duties as a ruler. It's no secret that the Medes and the Persians, they knew they were out there. They knew that they were looking to conquer his kingdom. But instead of consulting with his advisors and planning for the defense of the city, I think he was overconfident. He overconfidently used his authority to serve himself and his friends rather than make plans to protect the general population. He was ruling with a sense of entitlement rather than a sense of service. Number two, he misused the temple vessels, verses 2 and 3, used them for a purpose they were not designed for. He knew the Jews used them as part of their worship, so you might say maybe this would have been a better way of putting it, he intentionally offended and was disrespectful to a whole group of people by misusing the temple vessels. Number three, short one here, he had concubines. He had some moral issues here. He had concubines in addition to more than one wife. Verses 2 and 3 there, big mistake. Don't say any more about that one. Number four, he engaged in idol worship. He was materialistic. Verse 4 says he praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Good warning for us not to get caught up too much in our possessions. Sometimes wonder, I go in substitute teaching at the schools now, and things have changed so much the last few years. All the kids going around like this, and one of the worst things you can do, threaten to confiscate their cell phone. We're allowed to do that. Well, for the day anyway, we can confiscate it. And some of them, you threaten to do that, and whoa, it's like you want to take their hand or something from them. Number five, he was arrogant and full of pride. He lacked humility. He hadn't learned the lesson from from his grandfather here. Number six, he was disrespectful of God, disrespectful of the true God. He didn't acknowledge God's authority over him. He didn't realize that it was God that had allowed him to rule. And seven, and perhaps his biggest mistake here, he should have known better. He should have known better. Verse 22 says that he knew all this. He knew what had happened to his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. He was probably still alive when it happened and may have even witnessed it. But he didn't learn from it. The lesson didn't stick. And we might ask ourselves, do the lessons in the Bible always stick with us? We're given an opportunity to learn a lot of mistakes from people other than ourselves. And we might even ask ourselves, do we learn from our own mistakes? When I was a regular full-time teacher teaching my math classes, it came time to hand back tests and quizzes. Nobody got 100%. Well, once in a while, kids got 100%. But for the most part, kids always made mistakes. And I'd heard a quote, and I'd repeat it, and I'd say, you know, no mistake is a bad one unless you refuse to learn from it. So look over all the mistakes you made on that quiz or that test and learn so you don't repeat those mistakes. You don't want to repeat them if you see that kind of problem on the final exam, because the consequences are a lot more severe on the final exam. So learn from your mistakes. Sometimes when we take class time to review for upcoming tests, I'd refer to mistakes that I'd seen people make or students make in the past. You know, you don't want to make that kind of mistake. When you see in parentheses x plus 3 in parentheses, and then the squared outside the parentheses, x plus 3 in parentheses, the quantity squared, guess what most people put? X squared plus 9. That's wrong. Would any of you have said that? I don't know. Maybe you don't even remember your algebra. That's okay, too. Remember, it's x. If it's in parentheses and the squared is outside, then it's x plus 3 times another x plus 3. And so the final answer is going to be x squared plus 6x plus 9. Now, you remember that, and you'll probably get that kind of problem right on the final exam. Learn from the mistakes of others. That's the moral of the story there, anyway. It's to our advantage to learn from the mistakes and lessons that are passed on to us by other people. Better if we don't have to learn them on our own. Better if we don't have to learn the hard way. You do say that experience is the best teacher, or it's the most effective teacher. But if you can learn from the experience of others other than yourself, well, that's still better. Notice 1 Corinthians 10. I'm going to turn to 1 Corinthians 10 here. Or read it off my sheet here. 1 Corinthians 10, we're going to remind ourselves of a few relevant New Testament scriptures. We'll start with a look at what Paul says to the Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6. Now these things, and it's referring to the events of the Old Testament, the events and mistakes that the people made when Moses was leading them out of, leading the people out of Egypt. These things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink. They proclaimed a special feast and rose up to play. That's when they rose up to worship the golden calf. Verse 8, nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed, lest he fall. These things are written for us to learn from. Matthew 11, we'll go there. Jesus warns about the consequences of not taking heed. Matthew 11, starting verse 20. Then he, meaning Jesus, began to rebuke the cities in which most of his mighty works had been done, because they did not repent. He did these wondrous things, but didn't have the effect that it should have had. Verse 21, woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. They would have learned from what they'd seen. Verse 24. But I say to you that it should be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in that day of judgment than for you. People of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum were given opportunities to learn lessons that were not given to Tyre, Sidon, and Sodom. And for this reason, the consequences are going to be more severe. Chorazin, Bethsaida, Capernaum, you should have known better. Brethren, we know better. We know better than to repeat the many mistakes recorded for us in the Bible. We know better than to ignore the instruction and the warnings passed on to us by past generations. The vast majority of people in the world, society around us, they don't know or understand the examples that have been made available to us. And it means two things. Because we know better, number one, because we know better, we can live better, happier lives right here and now. I'm not saying we necessarily live easier lives, but we can live better lives now. And number two, because we know better, we may be subject to more severe consequences should we ever reject or ignore the lessons that we know, that we've learned. Belshazzar did not learn from the mistakes of his grandfather. And because of it, he suffered a more severe consequence than did Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had to live like a wild animal for 7 years, but he had his kingdom restored to him. Belshazzar lost his life. So, brethren, as we head toward the Passover and continue to examine ourselves, let's take some time to consider how well are we doing with the lessons we've been provided with. We could reflect on that, and as we come to our conclusion here, let's remember the mistakes of Belshazzar so that it won't be said of us, they should have known better.